I'm Layla Smith. I'm the CEO of Objective Media Group, part of All3Media. We're comprised of 8 production companies and our offices are based in Waterloo, central London. I've overseen programmes including I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, Piers Morgan's Life Stories, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and Hell's Kitchen. My most valuable piece of advice would be to be quietly confident, listen to people first and then make your point.
So what is it exactly that Objective Media Group does? I know that it's comprised of 8 production companies, but I just wanted to know if you could explain that for me in a nutshell.
Yes. So Objective used to be a production company, Objective Productions. And when I came in about 3 years ago, what we decided to do was make it a group. So Objective doesn't make programmes. The production companies that are here do. Some of them are owned by us and All3, and some we just production partner or we umbrella. And so some we're more involved with than others creatively, some we step back and we're just here to help them get their programmes on air, make sure the production management works and the legal and business works and all that kind of stuff. So what we've created is a really flexible environment where people that want to spend most of their time thinking about what's creatively happening in their production company can do that, and we will make sure that everything else that you need to do to get a show on air happens and happens well. And as I say, sometimes we're involved creatively and sometimes we're not, and that's kind of the arrangement that we have, and it seems to be working really well.
So can you explain to me your involvement in the Gordon Ramsay on Cocaine programme, for example?
Yeah. So Gordon and I worked together years and years and years ago, and when he was wanting to set up Studio Ramsay and they were looking for backing, they decided to go with All3 with Objective as its production partner. And that means I'll creatively get involved with Gordon quite a lot because we've got history and we strategically talk about where he wants to take the company. So some shows I'm really involved with and I executive produce, and other shows I do less on. So Gordon on Cocaine was something that actually Gordon and I pitched together into ITV, and then by the time that had got through the process of being greenlit, Chris Brogdon was already in place, who's the guy that runs Studio Ramsay. Mm-hmm. They brought in a really brilliant specialist executive producer because it's a very specialist area of television and a specialist team. And what I do in that environment is go, they know exactly what they're doing. They don't need me to meet with the executive team and kind of go, are you going to interview this person? But there are really high level checks you have to have in place, right, when you make shows like that. So before they went off filming, we all sat down, we talked about what they were doing, the protocols they had in place, mm-hmm, the way they were approaching it. And then you simultaneously do the same in the edit as well. So it's every show is different. That one was particularly interesting because of the nature of it.
And how long did it take to, from beginning to end, to sort of get that project off the ground?
Oh gosh, it was probably about 9 months from pitching it through to making it through to it then going out on air.
And was it received how you sort of anticipated it would be?
Yeah, I think what's really interesting about that particular show is it was out on ITV. You know, it's a mainstream broadcaster. Mm. It's dealing with a really, you know, high level, difficult, interesting, provocative subject. And yet I didn't really see criticism of it in the cuts and the press because Gordon did a brilliant job and the show was really well made. But the other thing that happened was my nieces and nephews, who were 17, 18, 19, all saw that show.
It was shocking.
I loved it. I don't know that they watch all the shows on ITV. Well, I know they don't. They'll watch some. Yeah. The fact that they found it and they couldn't wait to talk to me about it, I just thought was brilliant. I mean, that's exactly what you hope a show like that will do. So, you know, it found like a mainstream audience, but it found the people that we really hoped it would as well.
And your role as CEO of OMG, could you sum that up in one sentence for me? And what's a typical day?
Whoa, there's no typical day at all. So we've got an American office and we have a nation's office in Scotland. So, you know, I could be in LA or I could be going to see the team in Glasgow, or I could be here simply meeting all the teams, or I could be at a network pitching or channel pitching. So there's just sort of no typical day because it's quite wide and varied. Mm-hmm. But what it means in a nutshell is I creatively spearhead this business. And as CEO, I also, of course, I'm across the business side of things and how we're doing as a business and trying to grow the business, mm-hmm, and making us fit for purpose. But there's, you know, in the end, I was a producer. I've made programs. I've been a commissioner at a network. I have that bigger picture, and that's what hopefully I can do is like connect some of the dots, or sometimes kind of offer up a thought, which is, have you thought about that project going in this direction? And that's really, I think, the sort of the thing that I can bring that other people can't bring in the company, and there are other people in this company that do brilliantly at a lot of the other side of the business as well.
What would you say the sort of top three qualities are that you have that make you absolutely own your job?
Ooh, oh my gosh.
Just so I can take them.
Blueprint them. Top three. Being properly communicative, and I don't mean by that saying having good communication, trying to have proper, honest communication, because it's so difficult. Sometimes people are struggling with their business, sometimes they're struggling with something creatively, sometimes they don't even know they are, but you can see they are. So being able to talk to people and identify and have really honest conversations is a really big thing. Being approachable, because if I sit in my role and people don't feel like they can tell me what's going on, then you're completely shot. Mm-hmm. Do you know, being tough sometimes. Because actually, outwardly facing, sometimes you have to have tough conversations with people too. Yeah. And you need to have that within you, otherwise you're not going to be able to help everyone else either. Mm-hmm. And also, it's quite hard.
Well, I was talking to someone recently, Nick, and he described you as one of the most powerful women in British TV.
Well,
just want to know your thoughts on that.
I think he might have had a glass of wine when he said that. I think that's going some. There are some pretty powerful women elsewhere. But I think that that's really kind of him. But I think also what he's saying is what I think we're trying to do here is create an environment where really creative people do their absolute best. Mm-hmm. And there is, in any industry, there's madness. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of madness in television. And we're trying to be a bit less mad, trying to be really supportive. There are lots of people in these walls that do different things, sometimes could be competing. Yeah. And yet actually, we get together, we do drinks events, we do like a whole lot of things that we're starting to put in place, like, you know, yoga and mindfulness and all that kind of stuff, where people from all these different companies will come together and do stuff. And I think that creates a different environment. And I think maybe that's what Nick's touching on, is we are building something, but we're also trying to do it in a really good way, I hope.
Do you have the power, though, to sort of make or break a series?
No, I don't think I do, because I think what we will all do if you work in telly is you'll look at the list of stuff that can make or break a series, which is the scheduling, what it's up against, what actually happened on the shoot. Was there something completely unexpected that happened that you didn't know? If it's scripted or non-scripted, everything changes. So I think saying that would be like ridiculous. Yeah. What I do think I can offer is sometimes being able to input into a series some experience where something's about to go off a tangent or really off the rails, and be able to see that coming, because that's the one thing that experience gives you, is you can sometimes see it coming. And you can see it coming in weird ways. It's not even because someone said there's a problem, but you can just see in the office the team doesn't look happy, right, or something's going on or whatever it is, or there's rumblings, or suddenly you can see a lot of legal meetings happening that's not to do with there's a problem, but they're just really struggling with how to get it right, and they can't see their wood, see the wood for the trees. So it's that. I think I can offer that.
And what project have you worked on that did involve the most sort of legal boundaries? I don't know what the word I'm looking for. I know you did the CNN show.
United Shades of America.
Was there a lot of lawyers?
Interestingly,
in the room for that?
No. That I don't think that's one where you're butting up against legal boundaries. I mean, that was an extraordinary. I mean, it is now a very beautifully made, very wide, broad show. The first episode was the one that, like, really obviously caught huge amounts of attention, and that would have taken some negotiation, but we. Funny enough, I think, you know what it often comes down to? I would say, oddly enough, it's the reality shows. Because scripted shows, there'll be all sorts of issues that you have about people's estates or what you can say about certain things, etc., and then what's right for the broadcaster. And with and something like Gone on Cocaine, of course, like you really double checking everything you do. But a lot of the time in a reality show, it's where you've got sort of people in an environment that sometimes is very unusual, that's very controlled, their behaviour is very extreme, And you need to know that you have best practice in place when you're doing that, because you're doing that, you're creating that, and it's only happening because you've put it in motion. Okay. You're not filming anything that's happening and then maybe having a director's view on it, or a director's cut, or a point of view. I think reality shows can be, you know, and you only have to look, don't you? You know, you look at, if you go back through the annals of history, you know, Jade Goody and the Shilpa Shetty thing, and there have been things like that dotted as soon as reality shows have really come to life, and I think that's where you have to pay real attention.
And so a brief history of your career. So you talk about experience. What is it? 15 years at ITV.
Yes.
But before that, how do you end up at ITV?
Well, okay, the 15 years really describes how you get to a high level at ITV. So I came out of university, I did the thing that everyone does, you write to everyone trying to get a job.
What did you study at uni?
I did media and cultural studies.
Okay.
As it turned out, it was cultural studies. They'd added the word media because it got trendy, but I wasn't doing a practical course, I did a very theoretical course. So you come out qualified for nothing, which is what a lot of people do. So you write to everyone and you try and get a job. And the first piece of paid work I got, I might not have even left university then, was I was writing verbals for DJs at Radio 1. And it's, you know, it's a job where you sit there and you just basically use your brain and think, well, if it's, you know, a dance DJ, they're going to be interested in this dance show and this happening. And you're just writing stuff for them to cross-promote. And it was really interesting, but what the best thing about it was, I was sat outside the controller of BBC One's office whilst I was doing that job. And so you just start absorbing it immediately and thinking, oh, this is a really interesting environment to be in. Look at what's doing. And it was at the time Chris Evans was on The Breakfast Show, so there was all of that going on. It was brilliant. And I think from that, I just thought, yeah, I'm definitely in the right area here, carried on writing to people, and got work experience at a cable station that was Granada Television. It was when cable was just starting, and Sky was there, and then G Sky B started. And so I got work experience, and basically this is the tip for anyone. You go in and you just make yourself completely involved and indispensable, but like get into everything that you can get into and be helpful, because I did 2 weeks and they employed me at the end of the 2 weeks, and that was it. I just started.
I think, though, today it's so much harder. It's the getting in and proving that you're worth being in that building. And it worries me and frustrates me for a lot of young people who aren't getting considered, even though they could nail the job. And it all comes down to LinkedIn.
It's really
it's
hard.
And it's so sad.
What I do think, though, is what, especially because of the BAME initiatives and just the fact that people are recognising that it's BAME is very important, but there's also a thing you're right about, are we allowing different voices into the industry as a result of that? There's a lot of outreach programmes now, and what we talk about here is we have those sorts of things in place, but beyond that, we just want to go to some local colleges and just talk to people, because if you realise that you can get in, maybe people will continue to try. Because I think what's happened is people have almost stopped trying.
Absolutely, it's so
because they just think they're never going to make it, so they don't bother. And that's, and then we're noticing then a lack of those voices coming through.
It's almost like you want to be given the opportunity to just meet face to face with someone rather than sell yourself on a piece of paper. Would you say it was easier back then than it is now? Would it be so easy for you today
to have secured
that job?
Probably it was easier then. And I think the reason was, as I say, the course had changed its name purely because it'd suddenly become a very hot sort of area to be training in or going to university. So there just weren't as many graduates coming out thinking that this was a world they wanted to go into. I think the difference is now it is quite a sought-after area. People do want to work in it, therefore competition is rife. And then that's where, as you say, then people who have heard the stories of like, oh, I sent out 100 CVs, I didn't even get 5 letters back. I mean, just the non-response, you know? The non-response is dreadful. Like, we always try and respond to people. But actually, just things, you know what? I mean, like, it is, I think it's about going a bit younger again. So there are people applying for work experience age 14 that, you know what, it's really hard for companies to do work experience where people are leaving home, coming to London at 14. Mm. That doesn't really work. But what I've said to people like that is, you can come up for the day and I'll meet with you and a couple of people will meet with you and you can have a little tour of the office. Mm. That's something, because at least you're starting to see what it is. So it is hard.
And what advice would you give to someone who's maybe just come out of uni and wants to start a career in the entertainment industry?
I genuinely would say I don't think it's about having shot your own short film. And I sound really, really grumpy when I say that, because that's what a lot of people do. Because I think that what people want more than anything is they want someone that's going to jump in and get involved, be indispensable, do everything. And I think people do spend a lot of time thinking, I must create this amazing short film to show how creative I am. Mm. But actually what you want is someone coming and going, I did this at college and I've made short films and I've made radio plays and I did all that at uni. Mm. But actually what I'm also interested in is how your business works, what makes it tick, how could I get involved? Not a lot of people say that. They want to show you their short film that they made in the summer holiday. And at that point you go, there's a lot of people making short films and I want someone that's going to come and help us run this like office and make this show. And or you might be tidying up newspapers because there's just too many of them. That's how you start. And if you know that as the person that's applying for the job, then I think you'll do much better. And it's not about saying you're there just to make tea. It's just about saying that's real life, you know, come and help everybody and then you'll find your path.
Is this the role that you always saw yourself ending up in? Was this the vision? Was this what you were aiming for?
No. As in, I didn't have one. I've always said that to various bosses of mine over the years, which is, yeah, that 5-year plan's never quite got round to writing that. Never had a 5-year plan, because I just don't know how many people that do. I mean, I really don't. Yeah. I don't know many of them. Maybe I work in the wrong industry for that. Or maybe that's why. Maybe it is something you have in different industries. I think all I did was I came out of university knowing that at that point, particularly documentary was something that I was really, really obsessed by. I was watching a lot of, really wanted to get involved in. And what I did was go, I want to work in documentary, I'm going to apply to lots of documentary companies. Mm-hmm. And oh my God, I took years trying to get to the point where I could make a documentary, because I just had to make whatever I was being asked to make in that assistant researcher role, mm-hmm. or assistant producer role. And you sort of do that for the first few years of your career. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I never had a thing of going, that's what I'm aiming for, that's where I'm going. I think that just comes much, much later on.
And even then,
yeah, I think if you set yourself, also, it doesn't allow you to go on a terrible word on a journey. It doesn't allow you, you know, yeah. I thought I wanted to make documentary and eventually I got to the place where I started making proper documentaries and it was great and I loved it. But then this opportunity came up to make an entertainment show and I thought, I don't know how to do that. Yeah, I'll have a go at that. And then before I knew it, I was making entertainment shows and reality shows. And, like, if I had been single-minded about it, I might have missed out on that part of it. So I don't think it's good to be too blinkered.
Yeah, you've got to be flexible and sort of open to new sort of directions, I guess. Which brings me on to my next question, which was, how do you feel, like, what's your opinion on millennials and sort of dabbling in different careers with CVs that have just, you know, explored all different avenues? Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing?
I think it is a good thing. I think it goes to my point slightly of don't turn up saying I've shot a short film. Yeah. Some of the best people that I worked with when I was at ITV, so one of them was, they were a police officer and actually they ended up wanting a change of career, and because there was a lot of blue light programming at that time, that's how they found their way into television. They've gone on to be one of the best executive producers in the business. It's like,
that's,
you know,
so cool.
The fact that you can bring different things with you to a job is often brilliant. Yeah. So I think the millennial approach of, saying it's not like I'm going to do this one career, it's like I'm going to do this, but then that might inform that. I think isn't that the way the world works a bit?
Like, I thought so.
Yeah.
I thought it was a great thing, but I hear apparently not.
Yeah. I think what I would say is, what could come, I think what I've taken from the thing of people sort of being critical of it, what's not always helpful is when someone comes in and because they've done these three other jobs, they think they know how to do the job they're coming into. Like coming in with a level of arrogance, is maybe that's the thing, because also, you know, say I've got nieces and nephews and I've seen them go through girlfriends and boyfriends, and so you end up meeting a whole host of people, and God, the confidence is amazing.
Yeah, it's scary.
Really amazing. Yeah. And I think that's the bit of it. Like, I don't mind if they turn up and say, oh, I've learnt this in a previous job. Is that useful? Or I think we could apply that. Great. But sort of coming in feeling like they can tell you how to do your own job because of it is the bit where you go, enough. Mm-hmm. So that's the bit.
What are some of the insecurities you have in your job role?
So in this current role, I would say it's interesting. It's the point that we were talking about, which is how do I add? The thing that I will be careful of and I check myself about is, am I adding or am I interfering? Because I also have had bosses in the past where you felt a little bit like someone's sitting on you. And the way we're set up is not like, I don't see myself as people's boss in that way. It is a collective, and some people we have arrangements with rather than, say, fully owning the companies. So what I want to be able to do is make sure that I'm adding and not interfering or being a pain and just sort of being another step in the process of slowing things down. And that is something that I think about a lot and want to be careful of, because I also think there's a world where everyone can always think that they're adding, very proud of themselves, and actually they might not be. And there might be a moment for you to go, I'm stepping out of this. I don't need to get involved. You know exactly what you're doing. Mm-hmm. It's like it's an old adage in our industry, which is the commissioner that can never turn up to an edit and watch a show and go, yeah, that's great. Well done. Thanks for that. Bye. They've always got to give a note. Yeah. And I think it's like not being that person as well. That's something that I think I constantly watch for.
Sounds a bit like parenthood. Just knowing when step back and just...
Hey, doing all right.
I wanted to ask you about the gender pay gap, but I just want to touch on it, which is that obviously it's been suggested that equal pay for the same work in show business doesn't make any sense. Views on that?
So we've been discussing it. I tend to think that in showbiz, if you're talking about on screen,
I
tend to think that this is a historical thing we're dealing with rather than a current attitude in the main broadcasters. Because I have never, I promise you, never had a conversation where we have been talking about a woman doing a job front of camera and someone has said, fantastic, let's offer them less because it's so-and-so as opposed to male equivalent. I mean, it's never happened. Mm. We've always had a conversation based on, let's be honest, the budget of the show, that's the thing that determines it more often than not.
Yeah.
It's like, you know what, we'd love to pay them more, but this is what we've got. And so we're going to have to try and do a deal based on that. But what I do think is, historically, there were more men in front of camera, there were more men in positions of authority in front of camera, and so it was the male host with the dolly. And that's what's been changing in recent years. And what we're seeing now is the catch-up. Right. So I'm not trying to dob out of it, but I don't think that is an attitude that I can see in any broadcaster I ever talk to. But I think it existed like 15 years ago.
Well, I was going to ask you about the shift. Is there a lack of women on set? A lack of sound women, a lack of women editors? It is a male-dominant industry, isn't it? But are you saying that slowly you're seeing more women apply for these roles?
Yeah, slowly, I would say, because I think it is interesting that for some reason, I do think it's true that, and you know, God, it's terrible as you say this, because then there might be about a million women that will write to me going, that's absolute nonsense, I was prevented from being an editor because of these reasons. But, you know, we just don't see as many women wanting to edit or wanting to be a sound recordist or technician. And why is that? I don't know if that is literally natural aptitude, natural desire, but it's true, and I still think that's the case. Mm. So that remains the case. And is that something that we need to redress? You know, it is, because otherwise you will constantly go into those rooms and it will always be a wall of men.
Yeah.
So what is it that's not attractive about it then? Because I do think there is something about that, in that people aren't finding it attractive. Yeah. So how do we address those jobs being attractive to women is what I would say.
Gotcha. Do women in broadcast have a shelf life?
Gosh. Again, wonder if that's a historical thing where people might have thought that. But I mean, you know, God, when I have meetings with people who are older women broadcasters, mm-hmm. they're exactly the same as you have with some. Well, to be honest, they're, of course, as you'd expect, they're more informative, they're really impressive because they've just had these years of broadcasting. I sat down with Moira Stewart, we were talking about a really interesting project with her. It's great talking to Moira Stewart. Mm. God, you have an interesting meeting.
Yeah.
So I don't think they have a shelf life. I think there's a classic thing about ageism in our society. Again, and that ricochets through then onto telly, isn't it? Because you can go to a broadcaster and say, we've got this show, we want to do that, and they'll be like, oh, we're worried about shows about old people.
Yeah.
And so that can be about old people contributors, not people broadcasters. Mm-hmm. It's again about addressing that balance. Just because you have one show about an older generation doesn't mean you can have a second show. You can't have a second show. And the same thing happens, you know, but that happens all the time. That's a broadcaster conversation. You'll go in with the millennial idea and they go, oh, we've got a millennial idea. Because they're trying to sort of cover all bases.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a shelf life. I just think there's got to be ingenious ways of making shows that feel fresh.
What about the fact that I used to go to endless screen tests, meetings with production companies, pitch a treatment, and they were so interested when I was 23, 22.
Yeah.
And now that I'm 27, 28, I don't even get a look in.
Yeah.
What does that say?
I think there's a big thing in our industry, as you know, about new talent, people constantly going, where's the next piece of amazing new talent going to come from? Because, of course, it does happen. And so I think that that's why, as you said, there'll be a level of interest at a certain age because people are kind of going, well, let's meet all the new talent, see who we think we should be working with. Mm. And it's harder when you hit a middle ground of your 20s than to sort of be, you're not, because they'll think, well, there'll be a reason why they've not broken.
You're not the fresh meat.
Well, it's there's a reason that people will be thinking, well, there'll be a reason, so therefore we need to keep looking. And it's not meant to be dismissive. I think it's like they're kind of thinking, well, everyone's got to keep looking.
Mm-hmm.
And it's tough, really tough. I don't think that's an ageism thing, though. I think that's about a particular thing about new talent. Because there's a moment when you're new talent, and then there'll be a moment when 4 years later you're not new talent, so then you have to try and carve out a different way of re-engaging people. Mm-hmm. And I think, you mentioned it, treatments. I think the way to do that is by going in then with ideas. It's like, it's not about what you can do on camera, it's about what you bring to it through your intelligence.
So, Holly Willoughby, Davina McCall, Emma Willis, why do I keep seeing the same five female hosts on television?
Okay, so those names in particular are amazing broadcasters.
Yes.
So that's the reason why. The reason why you don't see other faces is because in those roles, it is hard to... I would call it the white heat of like mainstream broadcasting. There are loads of other faces, actually, broadcasting. But they'll be doing features programmes on Channel 4, they'll be doing, you know, daytime programmes, mm-hmm. they'll be doing whatever. But the reason why you name those names is because they're the ones that are hosting those big shows in the white heat of mainstream broadcasting. Undoubtedly, the whole quest for new talent is to find people to follow in their footsteps.
Yeah.
But actually, being able to do those jobs is incredibly tough and you have to be incredibly brilliant. And that's why you see a small collection of people doing them. And it's the same even with men, I would say. You can't name that many men that can take a big live show or a big end show or a big format.
You're right, Dermot O'Leary, Anton Deck, Philip Schofield.
Yeah. That's not a male-female thing. That's about they're very, very hard to do.
Yeah. So is the way the TV industry operates shifting?
In terms of the streamers or in yes.
So I read two things, which is no one's watching TV anymore, it's dead, or you know, this is the most exciting time to be part of the TV industry.
Yeah.
And everyone's adapting because everyone's online now. I mean what do you feel that stress? Is there a stress around it?
It's not stress. It genuinely isn't stress. That's not like a kind of, oh, it's not stressful at all. I'm really stressed, it's not stressful. It is just changing. So it completely is changing in that people... So I worked for 15 years at ITV. So I have had the doomsday predictions, like in various meetings, ad finitum, where, you know, the death of television as we know it is coming, blah, 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 when the advertising downturn was happening. And the simple fact is, normal television isn't dying. It will exist because it will always exist in a form where there's a collective view. Mm-hmm. And there will be, I think, always some shows, and it might be the soaps and big events and then other programming that then will exist around those things, or amazing drama that just, you know, immediately connects everybody and it becomes something they want to watch and as a serial. That will always exist because I think that sense of event programming and collective viewing is important to people. Mm-hmm. So I don't think television will die. Television will remain in its form, really challenging to bring a big audience, but amazing when you do it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you're right, the streamers are here, there will only be more of them. And it means that there's all this opportunity to make different type of programming for them. They have a different sensibility. They're not coming at it in a way where they want to like executive produce your shows with you. What they want you to do is say, we have this amazing show, we think it's brilliant for Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, for this reason. Mm. We've got the right sort of talent to do it. This is the show the shape is in. This is when we can make it, and this is when we can deliver it to you. And they go, brilliant. And it's different. Like they it's like it's like what they want you to understand is what a Netflix, Hulu, Amazon show is,
yeah.
and tell them about it, and then they want you to make it. And then you're right, and then people will watch Time Shifted in their own space, in their own time. But it doesn't mean they can't exist together. But for the television industry, that's quite a different process, because the conversations that you have with commercial, normal, or PSB broadcasting, mm-hmm. are that they're conversations. Like, do you like this? Oh, we quite like that talent. Oh, we're thinking about this, blah, blah. And that's great, and that's what we're all used to. Sort of different, I think, that, you know, the streamers, they really want you to come in with the whole package.
I was going to say, would you say that it was more that the television industry used to be in control, and now it's more the consumer? They're telling you what they want to be watching.
Yeah.
And it seems to be documentary, factual series now.
Yeah.
Do you know
or
why?
Some high-level drama box sets. Right. I think the two things that really work.
Kind of
yeah,
stuff.
You know, that stuff, like all the HBO big dramas and stuff like that really, really work. And then quite high-level factual documentary programming.
But sort of how it seems like audiences are getting more intelligent in a way, or they're wanting to learn something from what they're watching. So it seems it's gone from, you know, Britain's Got Talent and Big Brother to Gordon Ramsay on cocaine and sort of like Amanda Knox-esque things.
Yeah, amazing documentaries. I think it's cyclical. So I don't, you know, again, that this is the moments where you sort of wonder and go, am I just too old? Is it that I've become that person that says, I think it's just cyclical. But actually, you know, that is, the sort of things we're discussing is what people did used to watch 20 years ago. Mm. And then what happened was the sort of the rise of the format happened, and then the rise of the reality show. And I think it is possibly just one of those things that's cyclical. Like, people had a lot of that. And now what they're finding is that they can pick and choose on the streamers. And they're sort of picking and choosing the things that they haven't had in as much quantity on the mainstream broadcasters here, or the terrestrial broadcasters. Mm-hmm. And that's why maybe they're picking it up. I mean, this is my supposition, but this is what I feel. And that I think it will continue to rotate. And we'll go through an era where there'll always be the great one-off docs that happen because they're amazing. Yeah. But there'll come a moment when actually it's not all about where the next high-level factual sort of documentary series is. It will be about the next, you know, suddenly nailed it, exploding on Netflix is really interesting, isn't it?
Yes.
So, you know, that is a format.
Yes.
And you kind of go, oh, that's interesting, because that's almost like one of the first shows on the streamers that's sort of in format. And you go, oh, that's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think it will change and ebb and flow. I don't think it's about people going, they're rejecting telly and they want the streamers for this. I think we might find that what happens is television and the streamers do this lovely thing where what you're getting over here, we do more of the opposite here.
Mm-hmm.
And then everyone's happy. Let's be positive.
What makes compelling viewing? Is there a formula? Do you know it straight away? Sometimes, do you find that people will pitch you an idea and you're with it within the first sentence? Or sometimes it takes a bit more time?
Yeah.
Do you have the sixth sense for that?
No, that is a hell of a question.
I made it myself.
Yeah, amazing. So when I was a commissioner at ITV, so I did that for 7 years, so I had people pitch me ideas. If we come at it from that point of view, totally, there are some things that when people come in, you just go, oh, God, I get it. I want to watch it. How can we make that happen? Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean you're right, by the way, because you're just a commissioner sat there trying to... And also, you're doing it for your channel. You know, every channel is different. Yeah. But I do think there is there is definitely some things about some ideas that you can kind of go, God, if we pull that off, that would be amazing.
Something in that.
Something in that, thing. Yeah. In terms of then when you turn that into a television programme, is there a formula to what makes things compelling? I would say completely not. Mm-hmm. Like, it's the antithesis of that, almost. It's like, you never know what, like, bit of magic happens that makes something that could be potentially very dull absolutely amazing. And I think it's the exact opposite. It's, you know, it's like the right contributor with the right director with the most amazing kind of, like, you know, moment in time sometimes just makes sort of something beautiful.
Have you ever been in a situation where you've been like, this is a great idea, we can't help you, but I know someone who can, or this isn't for television, this is for this, and you sort of help them along the way, but you can't personally be of use? Does that ever happen?
Again, I can only speak for the time, like, the time at ITV is very difficult because if it wasn't for you, you hoped it would be for another broadcast. People did often bring stuff where you went, it just is not going to work on ITV, but it's a brilliant idea and I really hope you get that away. And if you know, if there was someone that I knew somewhere, a different broadcaster, well, I would say you should really take a look at this, you know, and you just don't know, again, what their strategy is going to be and where they're at. And here, though, I do think we see things all the time because people do come to you as a production company with external ideas, many of which you aren't right, can't help, but you try and point them in a different direction or connect them with something. And that's a really lovely feeling. And it's the same, not even with ideas, but with people. You know, you can't employ everyone. Yeah. And there are some really talented people, but then we try quite hard to try and connect them up with other people that we know, obviously, in different companies, thinking they should progress or do well because they're brilliant.
What's the worst thing on TV right now?
Oh my God, impossible to answer. A, because I don't watch enough telly, because who has enough hours in the day to watch everything on telly?
Is it because you're on Netflix?
Oh my God, yeah, everything is just it. There's Netflix, there's this, there's that. Trying to watch it all is quite something. Yeah. Worst thing on telly.
Okay,
I can't
okay. You don't have
that.
To be a Billy about it. What about like a genre of thing you can't stand?
I can't. The shows I find that I turn off.
Yes.
Are shows that just don't feel innovative. Because there are a lot of shows that sit in a certain area of the schedule and they do tend to be in that kind of shoulder peak area of terrestrial broadcast where they're doing something for someone, someone's watching, but the way it's being done just isn't fresh and new. And that's the bit of it that I kind of feel like, come on, people. Okay. I think we can all make shows that have been made before. Again, things are cyclical. Like, you'll find yourself making a show that's sort of been done before, but try and find your way of doing it, or try and do it in a fresh way or contemporary way, or put a brilliant new piece of talent on it, or a different host. And those are the shows. And there's still plenty of them around. And I think if you're a channel controller, what they're always saying in their sessions are, we need to find fresh new ways to, shopping. That's why they're saying it. Because actually there are shows left on our channel still where they're still doing things in a very traditional way.
Do you know what? It's interesting because people are bringing back shows. So, you know, we need a dating show badly. Yeah. And so they're bringing back Blind Date.
Yeah.
And is it Street Mate? Yeah. It used to be Davina.
Yeah. Yeah.
What does that say about the lack of innovation
in
this industry?
And it's really sad. It's also about risk. So if you're a channel controller and you've been trying some dating shows and they haven't been working, and then you think, I could get the rights to Blind Date and I could get it, like, and that's going to come back. There comes moments in your planning, I think, where you think, I think that would be a really good idea. And then it's about, as I say, how you do it. Because I think people are really up for a remake it's new and fresh and different, or there's just this brilliant idea for a host. And then there are some where they come back and you kind of go, oh, yeah, I've had a look at it, feel like I've seen the show anyway, and then you're never going to watch it again.
So what are you watching? What's the best thing that you've watched in the past couple of years? What do you count as a great piece of entertainment?
I find it very hard to switch off watching telly because I will watch it from an industry point of view.
Yeah.
So the shows when I really stop and get transported tend to be something like a box set. So I really loved Ozark.
I never watched it. First episode.
Did you? It was really dark and really brilliant. And Jason Bateman was in a role that you've never seen him in. But it also wasn't dark in a way that some... When sometimes on British television people decide to do something quite dark, then it's unrelentingly dark. Like, the picture's dark, the images are black, it's quite shady, everyone's can't quite see, and it's often raining all the time.
Yeah.
Like, they really go for it. It wasn't dark in that way. Like, the subject matter was dark. Sometimes you just thought, I cannot believe they just did that.
Yeah.
But it looked beautiful and it had this amazing open vista. And I just thought, oh, that was brilliant. And I love watching stuff like that where it just sort of keeps surprising you. Mm-hmm. And that's what I love. And that's when I find it easy for me to sit there and just go, I'm enjoying watching this, mm-hmm. as opposed to slightly analysing, like, you know, why they did that or why they didn't. It's really hard to switch that off.
Imagine.
Yeah.
It's all around you all the time,
yeah.
isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, I've got three questions, then we're so done. Where do you go for inspiration?
Oh, gosh. It sounds terribly trite. It's just life. Like, there's great friends that I have, and then my kids, and then you come to work, and then you read something really interesting in a mad article, and then someone says something in passing in a conversation, you think, oh, God, that's true. Everyone is obsessing about that. We should do a show about that.
Mm.
Like, just everywhere.
Do you find it difficult to balance work and your private life?
No.
Salty or sweet popcorn?
Salty.
What is the most important thing that you've learned in life and in your career? And we're going to end on this, so make it deep.
So the most important thing that I have learned over the course of my career is that it is okay to sit in a room and not try and own the room from the minute you walk in because you feel you need to. Because there you can be in a lot of rooms where you're running a show or running a team, and you don't need to be the loudest voice or the person that speaks first. You can let other people speak. And as long as you know, if you need to and when you need to, and you often do, I'm not saying you don't speak in that room and make your presence felt, but you don't need to be the person that stamps all over that room. And I think there's a lot of people that do that, and I feel that that sets a tone for those meetings or those companies or those experiences that cannot be the best.
And life? Or does that apply to life?
I think that applies to life. Like your relationships, how you conduct your relationships. Let people speak and then be part of it, as opposed to sort of saying, I'm owning this. I'm not even sure that I like that.
Two ears,
statement.
One mouth. I love that quote.
Yeah.
Deep. We're done.